Interim Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities, December 14th. Welcome, everybody, to the last meeting for this two-year period, at least, of this committee. I'm going to get us going, since I'm the one who's late. We have an informational meeting scheduled to begin.
I'm
going to go ahead and open our informational meeting. And we will, let's see, the first one is a discussion about what the Oregon Wine Growers, you may recall in the, whatever we were calling it, supplemental session, we passed a bill that was, put a sunset on it and involved sort of what's going on in the wine industry and the kinds of activities that they're doing other than just making wine. And we passed a bill through the, it was into law, and that set a sort of a threshold base level to give some certainty to some vineyards who were doing other activities so their counties at least could not shut them down, you know, at a really bad time, and give us some breathing room. And now it sounds like the wine growers have talked to a lot of their members and have some answers on what they at least would like to see happen from here as it pertains to that sunset ending, which I think we set it to end after, really in 2012. No. How did it work? We had this next full session, and even theoretically, the supplemental after that, but we really didn't want to have to deal with it in the other one if we can get it done this next session.
January 1st, 2013.
Yeah, January 1st, 2013, so not the 2013 session. So we either deal with it in the next 6 months, or theoretically, you know, we could deal with it, but we don't want to, is my view at least of it. So with that intro, Dan and Gary, you want to come up and join us from the OWA? And then after this, we're going to hear about other kinds of similar issues on other types of ag lands. And so we kind of put these together so you can see that this is not necessary. I mean, there's multiple legislative concepts, and we'll try and get some corralling around the different, for the members, different choices that we've got in front of us. Great. Thanks, guys.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association, and joining me is...
Gary Conkling, also representing the Oregon Wine Growers.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that setup. Today we wanted to share with you some of the information that we have learned from a member survey that we've done, and also town hall meetings, talking about some of these activities, commercial activities that are happening on EFU land at wineries. So we'll share some of that information with you. Also talk about a process that the Wine Growers Association has gone through since the passage of Senate Bill 1055 to talk about these issues, and then launch into a quick summary of a legislative concept that the Wine Growers Association has developed. Just a little recap on the wine industry. In Oregon, there are close to 400 wineries and close to 20,000 acres of planted vineyards. In 2009, almost more than 1.6 million cases of wine was sold. That equates to about 8,500 jobs in the Oregon wine industry, $200 million in wages, and adding over $1.4 billion to the Oregon economy. So it's an important ag industry here in the state. And what you've heard is true, that in the recent past, the wine industry, like many other economic segments in the state, have suffered with the economy. The harvest this year probably lower yields than before, but a lot of our vintners believe that the quality of wine in 2010 will be superb. So we'll find out in the next couple of years about that. Just a little bit about our association. We are a statewide industry association, 138 winery and vineyard members, 48 winery-only members, and 116 members who just have vineyard lands. All of our members represent the key AVA areas of the state: the Willamette Valley, North and South, Umpqua Valley, Rogue Valley, Columbia Valley, and Eastern Oregon, and Walla Walla. I want to launch into some of the key findings, and again, there's lots of data that we developed in surveying our members, so I want to focus on some of the things that are relevant to the conversation about events and activities on farmland. Some background on sort of the industry as it stands and how long many of our members have been here. It's interesting, it's a maturing industry, but lots of new entrants, as you can see. 30% of our members have actually been in the wine industry for more than 20 years. But at the same time, there's a sizable number, 40%, that have only been in the industry for about less than 10 years, 10 years or less. So there's lots of new players, lots of small players who are showing up, and it's a nice diversity with those new entrants versus the wineries that have been here for a while. Most of the wineries, as you know, are located in Yamhill County, but counties like Jackson, Douglas, and Polk counties are adding lots of wineries to their counties and to their economies. So it's certainly diversifying throughout the entire state. We wanted to now sort of talk a little bit about those commercial activities. Interestingly enough, of all the wineries who are our members, 30% of those don't have tasting rooms, but 70% do, tasting rooms and other things. There are some that just do tasting rooms only. Others have tasting rooms where they also sell wine in retail. Others have tasting rooms in event space. And many wineries, 31%, as you can see, have the tasting rooms. They have retail space and also space for events and things. Interesting stat that we learned from our members is 45% of all the wine sold by Oregon wineries is actually sold at the winery in the retail location, which is just, in our view, sort of a phenomenal number. And I think what it shows is that it's very important for wineries to be able to bring their customers out to the wineries to experience the wineries, the vineyards, learn a little bit about the winemaking process, develop that customer loyalty, and hopefully have long-term customers that they can get out of that. That's pretty phenomenal, though, when you think of buying wine in other places or nice restaurants on the East Coast or other places, 45% of their sales are actually happening on-site. And for us, that was a very interesting figure to learn from our members. There's been some talk, as you know, during the discussion on 1055 of what proportion of a winery's income is coming from those events that are happening at wineries on EFU land. And as you know, there's a cap of 25% of your on-site wine sales that your other incidental income can't exceed that 25%. Interestingly enough, 96% of the revenues are actually below that 25% level. And as you can see, more than half of the income that these wineries are getting from these incidental activities are less than 5%. So some of the questions about whether wineries are making lots of money on these incidental activities, whether it's retail sales of cork bottle openers or T-shirts or events that have food. As we've heard from our members, that's a very small portion of their actual sales that are happening on-site. So, some very interesting data that we learned on that point from our members. Absolutely.
I'm a little jet lagged, but so the bottom number, the greater than 25% is 4% of the total pie, which in some theory they're out of compliance.
Well, the one area, that's a good question, yeah. Mr. Chair. The one area that we haven't gone through and sort of filtered is that 4% could also be wineries that are operating under a conditional use permit, where they're allowed to exceed that amount. I'm sorry, I don't have a cross tabulation to find out.
Oh, for some reason, when I first looked at it, I looked at that big 54%, and I was looking at winery income, and I was looking at that big chunk and going, wow, that's a lot of people who more than half their income's coming from there. We got a big problem here. So,
quite the contrary.
Thank you. Sure, that was the only one.
And then the last sort of figure I'll show you, again, we have lots of data, but the last one I want to show you is we talked to our members through the survey about the importance to events of events for their commercial viability. And as you can see, 75% of our members said that the ability to do these events at the wineries on EFU is very or somewhat important. So even though a small number of them are doing these events and deriving income from this, they still think that that's important for the long-term viability of the industry. So wanted to talk a little bit about when we're in the conversations about events and what's happening on these EFU lands. I wanted to sort of separate events from what our wineries believe are sort of those activities that are important to the marketing, promotion, and sales of their wine. And there are things that are happening in wineries And this really goes to the discussion that I think we're going to have next legislative session on what are events. There are things that are happening at wineries that that are what we would term sort of the normal business activities of a winery as it's trying to market and promote their wine. And it could range from bringing in their distributors and their brokers to learn about the wines, to talk about opening distribution channels, educating the sales team and tasting room staff. There are some events or activities that they do to sort of promote the sales of their wine with their loyal customers. Those are the cellar clubs and special release events, winemaker parties, and hosting and entertaining their volunteers and investors, and also their restaurant partners. So as we continue this conversation about what's happening on wineries, what is an event versus what is not an event, I want you to just sort of learn a little bit about what these wineries are doing in the normal course of business that, again, are directly related to, as best they can, market, promote, and sell their wines. Now we're going to move away from the pretty pictures and just talk a little bit about the legislative concept. But before we do that, again, as you, Mr. Chair, noted during the conversation on Senate Bill 1055, there was a commitment by the wine industry to have this statewide conversation about commercial activities on farmland. And that led to the OWA, the Wine Growers Association, starting an internal process to talk to our members about those issues and what's important to the wine industry. After doing the survey that we've released data on today and previously, we went around and held regional town halls in all our regions to talk to our members to get feedback about these issues, and that has led now to a legislative concept that we'll discuss. We also were participants in the Associated Oregon County's Farmland Task Force, which I think you're going to hear about today. And then after having all this data, we had a committee deliberation and then finally a board approval to move on a legislative concept. So now I'll turn it over to Mr. Conkling to talk about our legislative concept.
Should we welcome Representative Gilliam or just let that go? I'm not sure. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Please, Gary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers. You'll recall in the supplemental session, there was a bill to pass and a bill 1055, and some energy in this committee was devoted to its provisions, which, just as a quick refresher, primarily were aimed at trying to make the connection between activities at a winery and the sale and promotion of wine. There also was a provision taken from the farm stand provisions to limit those incidental activities or the income from them to 25% of the on-site retail sales. So an attempt to both create linkage as well as put a limit in place. And then the sunset, of course, was designed to make sure that we had an ongoing conversation, which our members welcomed. The guiding principles that our board brought forward in discussing the legislative concept, which I'll present momentarily, is a strong sense that we need to find a balance between protecting farmland as well as finding ways to assure the stability of the farmers that are farming that farm. As part of the preserving the farmland quotient, our board feels very strongly that we need to make sure that permitted use wineries do, in fact, meet the minimum acreage requirement of 15 contiguous acres. We don't think there should be any rollback. This doesn't prevent smaller winery operations that can either locate in urban areas, sometimes in incubator settings, or in some cases even going to a conditional use permit. But as a permitted use winery, we think that 15-acre minimum is quite important. We do think that it is also important for the legislature to make clear that incidental activities that are in conjunction with the sale and promotion of wine are allowed for permitted use wineries, but at the same time that we don't essentially use that privilege to create event centers or wedding mills. So the legislative concept that we've developed essentially has a couple of parts. The first two provisions listed on the slide are really a pair. And what they do is essentially to take this concept. Instead of trying to identify what events are permitted or not permitted, or go through the Jesuit-like exercise of trying to identify how many angels can be on the head of a pin, it essentially says wineries can do those activities, as Senate Bill 1055 described, that are incidental to the marketing, promotion, and sale of wine. But it excludes from that privilege three particular kinds of activities, which to our members' ears and what we've been able to talk about are really the source of some of the consternation. One is weddings. Another are ticketed concerts, larger concerts. And the third is facility rentals. And our concept would say apply, those three are still permissible, but permissible through some type of a temporary or special permit that counties would have the discretion to look at. So depending upon the nature, the length, the type, etc., whatever the circumstances are, counties could apply appropriate conditions to those things, also providing transparency to neighbors. We think that this is a process that is relatively simple and elegant, as well as horizontally fair to all agricultural users. This is not intended just to apply to the wine industry, but it would make us no better, no worse than anyone else in those categories.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Gary, what was the third one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, facility rentals.
Rentals, thank you.
The a couple of the other provisions that we think are useful. One is, interestingly enough, the existing winery siting statute doesn't specifically reference tasting rooms. I think most people think of wineries as having tasting rooms, or at least having the right to have one. Not all wineries have them, but that's their choice. But the statute doesn't expressly allow that, and we think that's probably an omission at this juncture that should be corrected. To make sure that, in fact, given the concept that I described a moment ago, that we still don't have people turning into event centers and what have you, suggests that we retain the 25% limit on income from incidental activities relative to on-site retail sales. As you, I think, saw by our numbers, one of the concerns that people had about that number was that it was unfair to smaller wineries. There is room for almost any size winery to keep those activities there. And these incidental activities, by the way, in our view, would extend to if someone was given a temporary or special permit to do weddings or any other activities. All those things would count under that limit as well. The question of food service has been an issue. We're not interested in being in the restaurant business. We have a board member who used to be in the restaurant business. He was the owner and operator of Chateau Lynn in Ashland, and most everybody, I think, has had an opportunity to go there. It's a wonderful restaurant. Something in this neighborhood was his statement the other day at our board meeting: I would never run another restaurant in my entire life. There were a couple of words that I omitted there, but you can perhaps imagine that. That sentiment, I think, is fairly strongly felt among many of our members. At the same time, having tastings, having wine club events, some wineries do allow on-premise consumption of a glass of wine. There is a need for more than sometimes just crackers. There are also social responsibility issues about making sure sometimes there's available food. What we're trying to make clear is that wineries can have commercial-grade appliances. If you think about it, this is a critical part of any kind of food service to make sure, if nothing else, that you have a good commercial-grade dishwasher so that you can have a public health inspection and permit the limited kinds of activities that might occur. One other sort of interesting issue that our bill touches on that is a function of the maturation of the industry is that we now have six to ten wineries that are kind of bumping up against the 100,000-gallon limit. The statute references a higher acreage requirement when you get to that production limit, but it's sort of silent. If you produce 120,000 gallons after you've grown from a smaller winery, what happens? And what happens if you just do that 1 year? Do you need to go get a conditional use permit or what? With the diplomacy of maybe a discussion about peace in Bosnia, we didn't exactly figure out how to solve that problem, but we think that at least would be dealt with in the main by simply raising that production limit from 100,000 to 150,000 gallons. In terms of a footprint in a winery, most people wouldn't be able to tell the difference because there wouldn't be any difference. Generally speaking, that difference for a winery is capable of producing 100,000 gallons. There isn't much production capacity difference to actually produce more. So we don't think that it really has a significant land use consequence, but does sort of, at least for now, fill in an answer of what do you do if you grow large enough and go past that 100,000 gallon limit. There are a couple of other provisions that we think are important. One is a bill that you'll recall we brought last session and would bring back again, and that is to make sure that if someone is going to cite a tasting room using the farm stand provisions, that farm stand is connected with an actual permitted use winery. That is, they must meet the same requirements of 15 contiguous acres. This is trying to block what we think is a bit of a loophole and one that our industry isn't interested in supporting. The other one is essentially an encouragement for counties not to essentially allow sites to or allow winery licenses or permits for wineries that don't meet the minimum acreage requirement. We really think that it's a critical component to make sure that the original deal that was struck, that we are farmers with the privilege of commercial activities on that farmland, but to have those commercial privileges, we have to really be farmers. So we feel fairly strongly about that. Again, this is not an attempt to short-circuit new entrants in the winery world. Quite the contrary, as you can see by the data, there are many new entrants coming, and there are alternative ways for those new entrants to come. So, Mr. Chair, with and members of the committee, with your leave, we're glad to answer questions about the survey or our concept.
Okay. Vice Chair Krieger.
Gary, you've got this 25% in there. If sanitation health issues are addressed, and I realize that, for instance, a winery has two weddings, the next year they have an opportunity to have five, and if traffic's all right, access, that's going to be looked at by the county. Why would you want to restrict the income of a farmer to 25% when maybe his winery has a special setting that lends itself specifically to weddings? How does that hurt the environment? How does that hurt the competition? I just don't understand why we continue in this state to restrict everybody with 1,000 different rules, administrative rules. That's what you end up with. I'd like to see half the administrative rules go away, not add to them.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, appreciate the comment. These concepts were developed with strong involvement by our Southern Oregon members, and in fact, members from both Jackson and Douglas counties were active participants. I think they share the same perspective that wineries from the rest of our state, including Eastern Oregon and the Walla Walla and Columbia Valley regions, support, which is we made a deal to be farmers, but farmers that are allowed to do commercial activities, and that we want to strike that balance. We're trying to find a balance that won't inhibit a winery, particularly a winery in your area, to be able to do the kinds of things that allow people to come up, enjoy wine at the winery, but also to do it in a general setting, in a general set of context that doesn't turn them into event centers. Allows them to use events to promote the sale of their wine, but not really be event centers. To the extent that people want to be in the event center business, we have no problem with that, and counties have adequate tools to do that. We're just not trying to have the winery siting provisions be the path for those commercial activities.
Vice Chair Harmon.
Thank you, Chair Clem. You said the increase of $100,000 to $150,000 mm-hmm. would not necessarily increase. I'm giving you what I thought I heard, was that it would not necessarily increase the expansion of the facility, it would just be the expansion of the product. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orman, that's exactly right. If I could use the example of Adelsheim Winery, which, by the way, had a wonderful review today of its 2008 Elizabeth Reserve Vintage, so I'm putting in a plug for David. His is a winery that has bumped over the 100,000-gallon mark at least once, but isn't over that mark all the time. The physical facility doesn't change. He has a production capacity to produce more. It's just that when he goes over that number, based on the way he just read the face of the statute, we don't know what's supposed to happen. And in this particular case, we would just say, well, nothing would happen.
Okay. And follow up,
yeah, please.
Then the other thing, a comment that I would like to make about the food rules, which are, from my experience what has been happening in Hood River County, is that a lot of the food rules are extremely vague, and the sanitarian can make arbitrary decisions on a very vague rule. And I'm hoping that someone in this body might be interested in revising some of those food rules, because they are extremely prohibitive, because it's up to the sanitarian to interpret. It's not very clear, and having seen some of those things, in my opinion, do need to be changed.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Van Orman, I appreciate that comment, what we've attempted to do in the land use siting portion of this, which is where we're at, is to make sure that the installation of commercial grade kitchen equipment doesn't become a bete noire in the siting process, so that wineries that may need or may decide to have catered food prepared on site have appropriate facilities that can pass a public health inspection. We think that as we look ahead in our industry from the other part of our world, with the regulatory world, there are increasing pressures for social responsibility, and it is a normal instinct of our own wine members to be able to make sure that the consumption of wine is done responsibly, and oftentimes that means having some access to food. So what we're trying to do in the siting provisions is to make sure that those kinds of facilities can be included and don't create some kind of special excitement.
I apologize. It's obviously an issue of mine.
Well, it's a good issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Conkling, Mr. Jarman, I appreciate the opportunity I had earlier to get a briefing on this. Just want to be clear the concerns I'll look at. I think there are opportunities here in the legislation you're proposing, but it seems to me that we need to make sure in any changes we make that we are protecting the interests of adjacent property owners to pursue agricultural uses on agricultural land. Anything that we do that creates a hurdle or an obstacle for other agricultural uses would be something that we would want to try to avoid in any changes we make here. Likewise, I think we need to mitigate adverse impacts on our public facilities, and in that area I mean particularly the transportation system, the extent to which some of these ancillary activities would create traffic jams or a conflict between wine tourists and agricultural equipment that has to move on those country roads. I think those are things we need to mitigate as well. And finally, Mr. Chair, as I'm looking at this, I want to make sure that we're not tilting the playing field in to the detriment of existing agricultural and forestry interests in adjacent areas. But I don't think those have to be obstacles to pursuing, to moving forward on what you're proposing, just things for us to keep in mind.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, thank you for your comments, and I think we actually would share those considerations, and as I attempted to note in our guiding principles, particularly the first one, of making sure that people that are farming can continue to farm without neighboring activities impeding upon that. That's the reason why we came to the construction of putting the activities that I think most people have discussed as creating concerns, such as weddings and concerts, putting them in a special category where they do get special review, where that review would include adequacy of facility, the transportation, other conflicts. You know, if you're going to have a concert in a particular place, is it going to disturb your neighbors? All of those kinds of things would fall into those kinds of categories. So we attempted, at least, to our the best of our abilities, to respond to those considerations.
And if I might just clarify, Mr. Chair, thank you for that opportunity. We're not talking here about a vineyard owner whose daughter wants to get married on the family property. We're talking about a commercial activity where someone would make a commercial activity of having their property available to strangers for activities, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, yes. Thanks.
I have another question.
Yeah, we're starting to run behind because of my tardiness, but let's take
well, I just have one question, Chair Kleiman. In listening to what Representative Nolan said, it brings up the question in my mind, then what happens to the tulip farm out on Meridian Road that has extensive traffic during a period of time when the tulips are in bloom? So I guess if we're going to talk about things like that, I don't think we can ignore what's going on.
Which is a good segue into our next topic, which is all about that topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Because I can guarantee you it wasn't my genius. It was Beth's to try and put these things right together so we can talk about it all at one time.
Good. Good job, Beth.
So let's get Art and Mike up. Mike, welcome. We're used to seeing Art, so we're not going to welcome him quite so pleasantly. We like to see on the ground.
Yeah, he already informed me of that. So. Yeah. That was a perfect segue, by the way, to get us into our next topic.
How about that?
Yes, I'll pass it around for the rest of the committee to see.
I thought that was pretty apropos.
Christmas. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and here to wish you, among other things, happy holidays. With me this morning is Mike Brandt, who is the Yamhill County Planning Director, and you will be receiving a memorandum to the chair and the committee from Commissioner Mary Stern from Yamhill County, who was the chair of the AOC Farmland Activities Task Force. And she expresses her regrets for not being here. I'm sure you'll understand that, being that she's on a plane to Hawaii at this point for a well-deserved vacation.
He would understand.
Yeah, I would understand.
You would. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Association of Oregon Counties created the Farmland Activities Task Force in April of 2010 in response to basically three factors. One was in the fall of 2009, AOC had a presentation and a discussion about activities on farmland at their annual conference. And as that was probably the most well-attended event that we've had in quite some time, and as you can imagine, created a lot of discussion. After that, we also had, you had the discussion in February of 2010 about activities on farmland, and passed the Senate Bill 1055. In those discussions before both the Senate and the House, AOC expressed an interest in looking at activities and events on farmland, and made a commitment that we would, the organization would take a look at that and report back. That, coupled with a number of counties that requested that AOC do something because they were faced with events and activities that were either just happening, that created questions about compatibility and whether there was authority in statute or administrative rules to authorize some of these activities and events. So there was a growing concern on a number of counties in Southern Oregon, Central Oregon, and the Willamette Valley that were facing activities that were being taking place on EFU land. Might just add at this point, there was also a number of court cases that were being filed with respective activities on farmland in Deschutes County, Marion County, Washington County. And so these issues about events and the compatibility impact were something that was in the forefront. So that's why we did the Farmland Activities Task Force. The membership of the task force was primarily county commissioners. There were representatives of a number of state agencies, Department of Ag, DLCD, was a representative from the governor's office, and you'll see in Exhibit A of the report that you have in front of you a list of not only the members of the task force, but also what we called the interested parties. Which was a very long list of people that you can imagine that were interested in activities because they wanted to do some activities at this point, or they were receiving the impacts of activities that were taking place on farmlands. And as mentioned earlier, the Wine Growers Association was one of those interested parties at this point. The Farmland Activities Task Force worked for about 9 months at this point to develop a concept, or to address the issue and to develop a concept that you'll see in the report, and I'll speak to briefly at this point. But I do want to call your attention to the on page one of the report, to the purpose that AOC had in establishing the task force. And that was to review current patterns of use on farmland, to assess the impact and compatibility of agricultural tourism on farming operations in the farming community. Three, to identify infrastructure needed to support appropriate uses in agricultural areas. and four, to develop recommendations to minimize conflicts, because this is what it's all about. It's how do you manage, or how do you manage the conflicts potentially between events and activities that are taking place and the agricultural community at this point that's going on out there. Then on page two, you'll see a series of principles that the task force adopted at this point. And there's one that I want to, that was an overall principle that guided the work, and that was to create a level playing field in terms of the agricultural community, in terms of their ability to conduct activities and maybe events. Rather than to single out certain types of agriculture. I mean, and we know that we've kind of singled out the wineries at this point, but we have people that raise beef that want to do things. We have people that raise flowers. We have people that do a number of things, and it seemed to us that there ought to be, it seemed to the task force that there ought to be a level playing field and a path, if you will, for people who are involved in agriculture to promote farm use in terms of potentially having events and activities in conjunction, as long as they are reviewed and there's a path for that to take place. So I'll leave those for you to take a look at. One of the things that the task force did was direct their staff to conduct a survey of the counties to determine what kinds of activities, issues, concerns that were taking place. And you'll find in Exhibit B I'll call it a summary of that survey of the 36 counties that identifies the activities. And you'll see some counties had a lot of activities. Some counties had very few at this point, because given where we are, and certainly if you're close to population centers, you know, there is an opportunity for more people to come out to the farming community, and you'll see different kinds of things. But we also identified a lot of issues. And you'll find on page three a list of activities, and we've kind of grouped those under activity and events, compatibility, support services and requirements, questions about process that were issues that were identified as part of that process. One of the things that I think the task force found that some events counties have kind of found been creative and created a path, either through a home business permit or some kind of special thing when people have talked about can I do something and how can I do it. Other counties have looked at the statute and the rules and said, nope, you can't do it because it's rather prescriptive. So there's some gray kinds of areas that we found, and that counties were doing different things. So you found, as you have, I think, heard, one county will allow me to do something and another county won't at this point. Okay? So that was another issue that that we kind of grappled with at this point. So as a result of the discussion over that period of time and looking at some of the issues were facing the counties, the task force identified where we didn't really start out to do was the idea we might be able to do some things internally within counties rather to manage events, but we found that we really need some additional opportunities to potentially manage events. And so the task force identified a legislative concept that you'll see on page five. And it's kind of what I've described as three legs of a stool. And this legislative concept is intended to be optional for counties. It is amendments to 215, 283, sub 2, and the corresponding amendments to the marginal land statutes. The first leg of the stool would be to amend 215-283-2A, which is the provision for commercial activity in conjunction with farm. That has been interpreted to be fairly narrow in terms of what you can do by, certainly by the courts at this point. And so what we have suggested, what is suggested is that there be an addition to that section of statute that would allow for the promotion of farm use if the activities are subordinate to the primary farm use of the tract, so that commercial activity can include or may include the promotion of farm use at this point. So we believe that that will help and allow for tourism, agricultural tourism, and other kinds of events and activities that could take place under this section. And this is a conditional use permit.
And tracts, so like in our orchard, we have split up different pieces.
Right.
And so 120-acre tract over there, that might actually not, I mean, theoretically, depending on what I want to do there, if it's only 20 acres and I want to do something big, may not actually promote the use of that 20 acres. But over here, we have 60 others there, probably would be considered not the dominant activity on that track.
That's true.
Yeah.
And
good.
You could have a number of holdings at this point and have a permit potentially on one of the.
But Art, it's got the best view of Mount Hood and my whole place. I really want to. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I'm sure we'll work that out.
Yeah, all right.
Secondly, because events, you know, not all, everything fits into one nice little package and say, okay, well, just do a conditional use permit at this point. What we found is that some people want to do just a couple of events a year or a limited number of events a year. And so what we're recommending at this point, that there be an opportunity placed in statute for what we have called or termed a limited use permit. That would allow for, again, the promotion of farm use on a tract of land. And this is not, well, while it would be a land use action or a land use permit subject to potentially appeal at this point because it would be discretionary, this is a little bit cast a little bit differently. This permit would be personal to the applicant. So it would not run with the land like a conditional use permit. It would not be transferable. So if you got a permit, let's say, to have an event, and I sold my property to Mr. Brandt would have to reapply if he wanted to continue that activity or event in the future at this point. We've also identified at this point as a place to start the discussion a number of permits that could be issued to a person during a calendar year, and I've said that these permits would be good for each permit would be given good for a 72-hour period. So you could have an event that would be a Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday at this point, and you'd have the opportunity to set it up and then also to take it down at this point. And that these permits would be reviewed every 2 years. And then you'll see after that a set of criteria that would be applied to by the county in the review of that permit. The third leg of the stool is what we've termed a single-use permit, because some people want to have just one event a year. And again, if it is a discretionary action, it winds up being a land use decision. And this is a lot narrower than somebody that would want to have a series of permits. But we've created we've tried to be creative here, and under the single event permits, we've provided an opportunity or an option for counties basically to have an objective permit, to issue an objective permit, which would not be a land use action. So it could be done over the counter for one event a year, and put some sideboards on it in terms of the number of people that would attend, the number of vehicles potentially, the hours of operation, the fact that it could not have amplified sound at this point to address some of these issues of compatibility. And if it's going to be objective and not subject to review, that means the neighbor can't complain about it and but we want to make sure we address the compatibility as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So those are the basically the three legs of the stool to provide counties with additional opportunity to issue permits to authorize a number of the activities that are taking place on agriculture and forest land. It's more tools in the toolbox, and as I indicated, it is designed to be optional for the counties to employ, not required at this point. I do want to just, Chair Clem, make a comment. You'll see in the report that there's a couple of issues that we discussed that we really didn't take a position on. Like, one is, should there be differences between the Valley and Eastern Oregon, and should you have the same process? We were unable to come to a resolution of that at this point. But the task force does feel rather strongly about an issue that was mentioned a little bit earlier, and that has to do with commercial kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
After much discussion, and we've had the county health departments, we've had the Department of Agriculture dealing with health issues, we've had DHS coming in and talking about health issues and permits and all these kinds of things, the task force believes that commercial kitchens should be reviewed through a conditional use permit. That once you have a commercial kitchen, then the types of activities gets a lot broader at this point. And so I just want to highlight, because that was discussed earlier, that in this report and these recommendations, that commercial kitchens should be established through a conditional use permit. The other thing that we talked about is the level playing field. And in doing that, these recommendations, if a winery wanted to have continual events rather than, let's say, a limited number, they just apply for a conditional use permit. And there are wineries that do have conditional use permits that allow them, a broader field of activities and events that can take place. And it's worked at this point because, as part of that review, the neighborhood and the farming community has an opportunity to have input, and you have the ability to address mitigation measures and to ensure that public health, public safety, and sanitation is being addressed by those activities and events at this point. So that is the nature of the task force recommendations, and I would note that LC 1907, which I believe is in the hands of the committee, is an opportunity to bring forth the task force recommendations for the consideration by the 2011 legislature, and we hope you do that.
Representative Nolan, did you have a question too?
Just a quick comment. And Mr. Chair, it pertains, and I didn't think about it on the earlier topic, but as we move, particularly Mr. Schlack, into ongoing activities, I think we need to be mindful of what that does to the preferential tax treatment of the property in question. Because if that property owner is getting a tax benefit because they're engaged in an agricultural or a woodlot or a forestry or some other kind of natural resource activity, that's one thing. If they're now competing with an event facility that doesn't have that preferential tax treatment, I think we need to look at that as part of our keeping a level playing field.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, that is one of a list of issues that the task force was cognizant of, we invited the Department of Revenue to come in and address the task force on the question of taxation, and would just comment that through the conditional use permit, then if there's activities that are allowed that are not subject to the special tax provisions at this point, then those are identified and then can be taken into account as as property taxes looked in the future and whether things need to be exempted or not.
Thank you.
I guess my question is, you pointed out the commercial kitchen issue. Any other areas of inconsistency with respect to what our wine group was asking for and what you're working on here? And I look back in my history here, we've also got ranching activities in eastern Oregon where we can have guest ranchers come and do some stuff in very limited ways. There's a lot of those kinds of things that we've built in over the years. Are you saying it would be nice to get a consistent way of applying all those different kinds of things and eventually bring them under one roof, or do you see the need for specialty kinds of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roland, answered it in two different ways. One is we would like to see a very limited number of, shall we say, special kinds of things. And we think that, for instance, the rancher who's raising his beef at this point, if there's a way that he can promote his beef and have an event there, there should be an opportunity to do that, whether it's a farm-to-plate dinner, which we understand that those are taking place not only in Eastern Oregon but in other places, or whatever. So there ought to be opportunities for them to do it if you can do it in other places. And we think that this concept will help facilitate that.
So that brings up any more questions? Yeah, Representative Roland.
Yeah, just one. And that's the thing. I worry as we start regulating in different ways that we limit the creativity of the person out on the farm. Most of the farmers that have been around for 100 years are not farming the same thing they farmed 100 years ago. I mean, they understand the markets. They have to live and die by them. They understand their land and what it can do. And they're open to new things that come around that can make their ability to stay in business productive. And, you know, I grew up in Port Angeles in the Squim Valley. It was a very unique place as a kid. We went out and did our strawberry picking, and they had all sorts of stuff in that valley that were available. And a different mint became the big thing, and you could barely breathe when you drove through with all the mint. And okay. And now there's 50,000 people that show up on a weekend to do Lavender Fest. So the land has been there, and the people have taken advantage of it in lots of different ways. And I worry that we start putting in things that all of a sudden start limiting that ability of that creative person to use that land productively in some new process. And that has concerned me for a long time. Oregon's done a much better job over time. I mean, I think then I go back and visit family, and there's not much of a valley left. You know, the irrigation stitches are still going, but it's kids playing in them, and it's not because they're using them for irrigating in the Squim Valley. So I want to keep that farm, but I want to also make it really possible for people to be successful at their jobs. So having the ability to do some of these things might keep that farm for another 100 years, whereas not having the ability ends that, and we have a weed patch or whatever because nobody's doing anything with it. That would really be frustrating to me. So do you, in your opinion, you're offering more options with this than what we currently have to keep those farms going?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roland, yes, we, in our opinion, that this would provide more opportunities for the establishment of events or activities that promote farm use at this point. We specifically don't believe that we'd want to identify events or activities or whatever, because things are going to change. And you'll notice we're talking about a process where the person comes in and identifies what they want to do. Now, they may have to do that from time to time, but as things may change, but at least it provides them a venue and an opportunity, and not to identify particular kinds of things that this is allowed and this is not allowed. We believe that would be going down a bad road at this point. Wanted to respond at least to your question a little more specifically. We have had a lot of conversations with the Winery Association, and there are more things that we agree than we disagree. We may have some, and we want to continue to have some discussion with them with regard to some of the elements of their proposal at this point. But there is a lot more agreement than disagreement, and we're hoping that we will be able to address all of those.
And that was going to, well, so I'll conclude later. Representative Krieger? Vice Chair Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel some of the concerns that Representative Rowland talked about. There's an event that's taking place in Curry County there that wasn't there 4 or 5 years ago. It is a huge income for this ranch. 4th of July event, 2,000 people, 400 tents, concessions, food. Hasn't no conflicts. Sanitation, water, everything's been taken care of. Transportation's okay. Used to be a mill out there, isn't anymore. You're going to have to grandfather in some of these events that have been getting these special permits that go way beyond this 500. It's a one-time-a-year event. So we need to have a conversation about those abilities for that farm or ranch to be viable because now of that event. That particular ranch has some timber land. You can see this year that timber wasn't even worth cutting. But their taxes went up, their insurance went up, and these type of events help cover those increased costs when the income from those property isn't able to do it anymore.
So any more questions on this for folks? Okay, so my intent is to still try and actually see what we can do to make these concepts mesh so they're not winery and everything else. And, you know, we have a limited amount of committee time, obviously, this next session, a number of days, and lots of other stuff to do. And I know most of you didn't even want land use in this committee to begin with, and I don't know if it will be or not. But the bill's got to go somewhere. So if it goes here, I still want to work between now and then to see if we can try and get this into closer to one package so there's not the disparate treatment. It may not, you know, be entirely possible, but I want to keep working
on
that.
Yeah. We'll make it.
So that's what we've got on this. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to move us into our renewable energy policies. I'm sorry. Why do I always try and give you short shrift? You've done such a good job, and you've got a consensus prospect. I'm never letting them talk about it.
Brian, one of my best friends and campaign manager just died.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
So I'm going to leave for a few
Sure.
minutes.
I'm not very sorry.
Yeah. First of many days in the sun for Representative Wingard.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Do we have everyone here? Where's our head? Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Wingard. I am a representative from House District 26.
Mr. Chair, what area is that in the state?
He loves to hear me
say something about a green hat and some sort of feather and Robin of Locksley.
Oh, yeah, that was it. For the representative from small towns, I represent the communities of Wilsonville, Sherwood, Bull Mountain, and all of rural Washington County out to Gaston, and it includes Hag Lake.
Oh, thank you.
And welcome.
Second largest district in the state. At the November 18th meeting of the House Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities Committee, we heard from a panel of folks about farmers markets and some of the regulatory challenges that the Department of Agriculture and the markets were dealing with. The chair established a work group and asked me, who knows why, to take the lead in trying to work with the stakeholders to find a compromise that would work for everyone. Over the course of the interim, the work group met repeatedly and, I think, successfully to develop a piece of legislation that will be introduced today. I have the easy part. I simply introduce the others. Joining us today, we have... Lauren?
Lauren Turek's here.
Okay. We have Vance and Lauren. Lauren Henderson and Vance Beebe... Bybee?
Is it Bybee?
From the Department of Agriculture. They're going to provide the committee with some background on how farmers markets have been and are currently regulated.
Also, Rebecca Landis, the manager of the Corvallis Albany Farmers Markets and the co-chair of the Issues and Advocacy Committee for the Oregon Farmers Markets Association, is joining us to help explain the concept that the work group has drafted.
For the record, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Just as a very quick background, because I know you're late, short on time, ODA has a long history of working with the farmers markets in Oregon, dating back more than 20 years. Most recently, trying to provide education and outreach in a regulatory structure that didn't fit them very well. They were kind of left in limbo. It was confusing for our staff. Representative Van Norman, you brought up the issue about unclear answers sometimes, you're right, particularly in this area. And so we have talked with Chair Klim and discussions with Representative Wingard about a way to make that more clear so that the roles of our agency and the producers themselves would have a better idea of what they could and could not do under the licensing scheme and what have you. We take our role for food safety very seriously, and at that same time we take our role for helping agriculture producers in this state find avenues to market their products. This bill draft, I think, lands somewhere in the middle. It does that, we have been pleased to be part of the work group and certainly appreciate Representative Wingard's efforts with that. And so I'll stop there.
Okay.
And you have 3 minutes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank the committee for providing the Legislative Work Group forum for some work that will foster progress of farm direct marketing in Oregon. On behalf of Farmers Markets and the farmers who participated in the Legislative Work Group, we particularly want to thank Representative Wingard and the high-level ODA staff who took all this time to work with us concertedly to reach good decisions that I think are worthy of broad support. Reducing regulatory uncertainty will ease the entry of farm direct small and medium-sized farms into Oregon's food industry. The farm direct sector has grown to a point where farm direct marketing bill is clearly needed. Oregon is home to more than 120 farmers markets, plus many other forms of farm direct marketing, including subscription boxes known as CSAs and the more familiar farm stands. The draft before you clarifies things that have been ODA practice for many decades, but which lacked a clear statutory basis we could rely upon. For example, ODA has not licensed farmers market organizations, and now we have proposed language specifying that the presence of farm direct sales does not make the spaces where those sales subject to licensing. This clarification will apply to any farm direct venue that does not otherwise require a license, so it could even include a church bazaar that wants to host a local farmer. As in the past, direct marketing farmers themselves will need to maintain licenses for some products and not others. In addition to historically unlicensed fresh fruits and vegetables, herbs, eggs, honey, and items like garlic and potatoes that are typically dried in normal post-harvest handling, the bill also would add dried fruits and vegetables under certain circumstances, nuts, shelled and unshelled, hold a couple different kinds of grains. I'll proceed here. And a category called acidic foods that includes fruit syrups, preserves, jams, fruits and vegetables, and all of these need to either be naturally acidic, lacto-fermented, or acidified according to federal standards. And we believe this bill will create some flexibility to test market new value-added products for farmers who sell directly to consumers, and I want to underline that's what this is all about, farmers who sell directly to consumers. It also sets strict limits on certain foods, including additional labeling and annual sales threshold on some of the producer-processed products that I've listed above, prohibition on commingling. So in other words, I can't throw one cucumber in a batch of pickles and say that it's mine and the rest came from someone else. That's not allowed under this bill. And when these limits are reached, farmers will either license or hire a licensed co-processor. We believe these goals are accomplished without imposing a significant safety risk to consumers who appreciate the 100% traceability of buying directly from local farmers. We look forward to working with ODA to implement the provisions of the bill we ask you to introduce today. Thank you for making it possible.
That's our panel. Any questions for these folks? I don't know if any of you remember the initial hearing, but I mean, it was sort of thorny and some grouchy situations, and so Representative Wingard really has done a nice job. I was only able to make a few of the meetings myself, so I left him to his own devices, and we've come back with a nice product. I think we should all thank him for that.
Well, I would like to know about his devices.
You could use a few.
Was violence involved? Or?
I would like to make a comment.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I just would like to comment that on the food rules, the difficulty is so typical of many things in this state, is that Ag has a part of it, Department of Human Services has a part of it, and the Health Department under Human Services. And it's just this complexity of all of these different bodies making all of these rules that I think make life pretty difficult for a lot of people, especially the people who want to promote the rules. Not a criticism, it's just a comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orman, I think while it may have seemed like there was contention, when we got in the room and actually started talking through everybody's roles and desires, there really wasn't a tremendous amount of space between us, and we were able to, I think, craft a bill that people felt comfortable with. And the overriding goal was to recognize the reality that was already occurring and to get at exactly, I think, what you're talking about, which is to not be overly regulatory burdensome, if that is such a phrase, on this budding industry. But it is mostly small business owners, really. I mean, in the purest sense of the word, and the farmers markets are creating something kind of new, not new in a totally unusual sense, but I mean, they're growing and thriving, and our regulatory regime doesn't quite fit for what they're trying to do, and we wanted to, in the bill, to make sure that we essentially allowed these incubators, which many of them are, some of them will remain small probably forever, but many of them are just people experimenting and trying to get into the market, and then ultimately they will reach these thresholds, and they're going to be working through processors, and you've all seen that. You've seen that in your own grocery store, that local products begin to show up and become, they proliferate. And something that was once a tiny little niche product becomes very popular and becomes more mass-produced. And they would, of course, graduate out of this bill at that point.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
I apologize. I did not mean to reflect on what you've been doing or even the subject of your committee. It was generally an observation of the whole process, period. Outside of when, as a person who's out there trying to have a food experience, I can tell you it gets pretty complicated.
Mr. Clem, Chair Clem, not to belabor this, but I think Representative Van Orman has raised an interesting issue, and I find it helpful to remind myself that things don't get into statute unless we, the legislature, put them there.
That's right.
And so the accretion over time of a little piece here to address an isolated issue and another piece over here to address a different issue and another piece over here to address someone's priority from the ends up without, if we don't do a regular review such as this represents, it ends up with a bunch of disconnected stuff.
That's right.
But let's remember, we or our predecessors put all that stuff there.
Thank you for clarifying my point.
Chair Clem and Representative Van Orman, to maybe help you just a little bit, we've recognized what you're saying, and the director's office of the Oregon Health Authority and ourselves are having a discussion about being consistent across the two agencies, and we do have a stakeholder group that is made up of stakeholders as well as the two agencies working on a state food code, one food code that is as possibly together as it can be between the health division and what they do with restaurants and what we do, and that work is ongoing.
I'm very happy to hear that.
Okay, good work. We'll get it done here in a few minutes when we do the bill introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good job.
I mean, hopefully between the last one and this one, and then as we get this facilitating development within the UGB product done, I mean, there's going to be a theme of some, I wouldn't call it wholesale massive deregulation, but some deregulation in a bunch of categories here that will require some people use a little more common sense, and there may be a, you know, there may be something that comes up that happens because we lighten our touch a little bit from the state, and you know, that's how these things got in there in the first place, was usually in response to some incident. So we're going to have to each be willing to accept an acceptable level of risk, that when somebody sees love as an ingredient in their cookie, they don't actually literally think there's some chemical in there called love. And that was one of the things that prompted this whole deal, was a regulator was upset about the word love being in the ingredient list on a thing of cookies at a farmer's market. So we're going to have to get over some of this stuff and review it as Representative Noel.
I rest my case.
Okay.
Wait till the legislature tries to define love for statutory.
Under a scientific basis. Right.
And only in
okay. So we're going to move into our next topic area, renewable energy policies, and ask Paul Wooden, Judge Gary Thompson, and Alan Ford to join us at the dais.
Let's just flush that out of our...
Yeah,
I know. I feel it's like pornography.
You know it when you see it.
You know, I hate to say it.
All right, so the order I've been instructed to call you in is Paul, the judge, and Alan Ford. If that's not correct, then please tell me. But I've been given a specific ranking here somehow, and I don't know how that works, because I see CEO and judge now behind executive director. So you guys tell me how that works.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Wooden. I'm executive director of the Community Renewable Energy Association.
I'm moving up.
We're an organization made up of rural counties and small businesses that support community renewables in the state of Oregon. We are interested in low-impact hydro, biomass, small wind projects, wave energy, geothermal, solar, etc. And our goal is to support effective state and federal policy to allow these projects to move forward. Oregon's facing some of the worst budget shortfalls we've seen in years. There's a couple basic ways to address budget shortfalls at a state level. One, obviously, is cut revenue expenditures and trim back the budget. And the second one, which is probably as effective or more, is to put in place policies that create jobs and generate tax revenue from new businesses. Now, there's an old adage that governments can't create jobs. It takes industry to do that. But the corollary to that is government can put in place policies that stimulate industrial growth. We, for the last 5 years in the rural communities, have seen some of the best revenue generations and job creations that we've experienced in years. It's had the impact in rural areas that the heydays of the timber industry and the fishing industry brought to Oregon, and it's one of the new replacements for economic growth and stability. You're going to hear from a number of people involved in renewable in the rural area. Judge Thompson from Sherman County. We also have Judge Shaw from Gillen County, who won't be speaking. Alan Ford from the biomass industry. We're going to have Don Coates, a farmer working on a community project. And Jeff Bissonette, who's been a staunch advocate of community renewables from the Citizens Utility Board. You'll have two handouts from me for my talk. One is fairly thick document addressing the myths around Betsy and renewables. And then the second one is the result of the last year's CHEER selections of projects. There's a lot of myths surrounding Betsy and renewables, and for people trying to cut budgets, that has been one of the ones that's been on the block. But I'd like to explore some of those myths for a minute. One of the myths is we can save millions of dollars by stopping out-of-control state spending, and that therefore we need to dramatically reduce Betsy and put stringent caps on other renewable projects. Well, the reality is that Betsy is only applied once a project has been built, constructed, hired jobs, and is on the tax rolls for personal income tax and property tax of both the project and the new jobs. What is deferred for 5 years is the income off of the project. There's no check written when a project comes online from the state. The only thing that happens is they forego 5 years of income tax to create new jobs. So the thought that somehow we're saving money by not applying Betsy is not a correct understanding, but it's one that's prevalent in people's minds at the moment. One of the second myths that we deal with a lot, and I hear it from time to time as I go around, is that there's no jobs created in the wind industry. I think everybody understands the jobs that are created in solar, where we've brought in new businesses, Solar World, et cetera. But there's a misconception is that somehow the wind industry in the rural areas doesn't create jobs, and that's grossly incorrect. During the construction phase of a project, there are a whole series of good, solid-paying jobs that take place, from union electricians, union crane operators, iron workers, truckers, foundation experts, local cement batch plants get a big impact during the construction. A lot of civil construction workers for foundations and site preparation. Meteorologists are hired, civil engineers are hired, electrical engineers, biologists for siting, permitting companies, and attorneys and accountants. There's a lot of activity takes place to build one of these small projects. Then once they go online, there are permanent, well-paying technician jobs that stay with the project throughout the rest of the life cycle. So the belief that somehow jobs aren't created on these smaller projects really is not correct. Another one I want to talk about is the impact that has happened on the community scale or smaller renewable projects over the last couple of years. Fortunately, for the last 2 years, in legislative process, both the House and the Senate have recognized that there is benefit to the small community projects. And while they have done things to change the policies, they have voted to keep the programs for community projects basically intact. But the problem is you can make good decisions, but beware of unintended consequences. The second handout I have for you is a two-page document with a bunch of yellow highlighting. Last session, we put in place the policy of having caps to limit spending. And so the projects that came forth in the last 2 years went into a cap program where projects were evaluated and only those that the state could afford were chosen. The first page is what we got when we applied for pre-apps, pre-certifications for Betsy for Tier 3 projects, which are $6 million and above. There was only enough funding that the top three unmarked projects were chosen. All of the remaining ones did not have enough funding in the Betsy program to move forward. And these projects, for all intents and purposes, except for one or two of the large commercial projects, are basically dead in the water now. The best they can hope for is that when Betsy's refunded, they might be chosen. But obviously, you can see from the number chosen versus the number not chosen, the probability is fairly low. The second page were projects that were submitted for Betsy pre-certification from Tier 2. And again, you'll see 10 projects that were chosen, but 23 that were not. Now, that means 23 projects that could have created jobs, could have created revenue for the state, that did not move forward because of lack of funding in the cap. We're not saving money by keeping these projects from going through to completion. And there's a number of good ones in here. One of my own personal favorites is that there was a small wind turbine that was intended to go in the Port of Arlington for the local school so that kids could start to get an experience for what renewables meant and help prepare them for college. It wasn't funded. And since then, they have drawn their request for application now because they don't want to go through the risk again. The document I'm talking from is fairly long, so I'm just going to talk from the highlights so we can move on to other discussions.
That would be helpful.
Community renewables have done a lot for the rural area. Renewables in general have. But we're in the process of basically putting a stop to them. No one is going to spend their own family money to try and build projects with the understanding that 1 out of 30 of those projects will be funded, or 10 out of 23, depending on what tier they are. So there are some things that if we want to continue rural renewables that we have to address this session. The first one is that Betsy is due for sunset at the end of 2012, and they will not be taking new applicants for pre-certification after 2011. If we don't extend the sunset, which I believe will be coming out as a bill later on this session, Betsy will die. Even if you want programs or you want policy, if it isn't extended, it's done. So the first ask is to extend Betsy somewhere into the 2016 range so that projects that are starting to consider development have some confidence the program will exist by the time they are ready to apply for it. The second ask is, whenever possible, eliminate the caps on the community scale projects, which includes net metering and 10 to 15 megawatt projects. Eliminate the caps or fund them enough that we have some confidence these programs are going to go through. We can't operate in a lottery atmosphere where you have 10 or 15 projects that have spent money and we only choose one or two of them. We need to get back to philosophy. If you build an acceptable renewable energy project, that Betsy will be there for you. You're going to see a number of budget proposals this session. Some will improve the budget through reductions and through reorganizations. Some will appear to be attractive, but in reality, they'll actually cost the state more than they save. I had an adage from when we used to live in the aluminum world, which was, be very careful you don't step over dollars to pick up dimes. And in the case of renewables, what may be an attractive idea to save money will in all probability cost the state far more than they've saved. So with that, I thank you. I appreciate your time. And the next gentleman to speak would be Judge Thompson from Sherman County. Are there any questions before we move on?
Well, we're just going to move on.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll do questions at the end. Thank you.
Okay. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Thompson. I'm a Sherman County judge. What I'm here today is to show you two pieces of paper. I've given you two pieces of paper showing the 09-10 tax revenue and the 2010-11 tax revenue off of, admittedly, these are big wind farms. They're not community wind farms. Showing you strictly the tax revenue, the property tax revenue that's coming off of only the wind farms. Sherman County is the second smallest county in the state. We've got approximately 1,800 people living in the county. Our normal tax revenue off the properties in Sherman County, which is all 99% of it is ag EFU ground, is approximately $6 million. If you just look at any one of these, this is it. These taxes are in addition to that $6 million. You're probably some of the first to see this spreadsheet that I've done, because I've been trying to stay out of fire, because I realize the state of Oregon is looking for money, and I've been trying to stay sort of low key on the whole issue. What these tax revenues have done for the county is we've got a brand new library built at the high school. It's a public library that we built on school grounds so that the public can go in and out of it and let alone, and also the high school students can use it. A little over $1 million investment. What we've done with these tax dollars, we've put in away 40% as a rainy day fund, which I think the state of Oregon would be wise to do also. We're putting 40% of these dollars away and putting them so that making it difficult for future county commissioners to spend. The balance of it is paying off a lot of the loans that the cities have gotten for sewer projects, some of the bonds. We're paying those off so that the cities can operate a little cheaper. We're also giving each one of our cities, there's four, $100,000 to do as they want with, no strings attached. Plus, we are funding a teacher at this high school to teach renewable energy. We're one teacher plus a science teacher and a math teacher to help fund for education. One, I believe, is in the grade school, the other one is in the high school. So when you hear people say that these wind towers are not making any money for the state, when they say there's no money moving in and out, I've got proof that they don't know what they're talking about. Also, in 2008, when these all started, the personal income from Sherman County was, well, actually in 2005, the personal income, the average personal income was $29,000. In 2008, when a lot of these were being constructed, the average income jumped to $45,200. We went from somewhere around one of the lowest to the highest per capita income in the state. We beat out Clackamas County by a couple dollars. This is all because of the wind farms that have moved into Sherman County. I think I've said enough. I better turn it over to
at the top, baby. So before Mr. Ford gets to start, since I have him at my mercy for the moment, I wanted to welcome you to our committee. Mr. Ford is one of Oregon's leading citizens, and I had the pleasure to watching his wife receive an award recently at the Solve Banquet, the Tom McCall Leadership Award. And I shared with them afterwards that on a personal level, many of you know I was at the Student Assistance Commission before that. One of the things they do is help administer the Ford Family Foundation scholarship, which is something available because of the generosity of this family. And I mean, I met lots of those recipients over the time, getting to see the banquets and things, and just a tremendous number of people's lives changed by this family, including my own family, where my brother, one of his summer jobs when we were at Marshfield, was to drive down to Dillard and work at the mill doing computer stuff, and then he spent a lot of years at Weyerhaeuser Corporate because of that, and is at Microsoft now, all because of, you know, that opportunity, you know, when we were 16, 17 years old. So welcome, and if Senator Edwards came, wanted to hear your comments as well, and certainly wanted to thank you. And Beth is telling me that Representative Roblin has something he'd like to say.
My last legislative assistant, who now works in Washington, was one of the Ford Scholars. And so, you know, it goes across the board. She was also a student body president at Marshfield High School, and I was there. But what you have done with your foundation and the impact it's had on lives in Coos County kids that I know personally is pretty remarkable. And so I want to just go add on to what Representative Clem has said. It has changed lives, and it has given people opportunities they would not have had otherwise, and it is pretty remarkable. So thank you.
I'm not going to talk about the U of O Alumni Center, because I know you do a lot of OSU stuff, too, but we're just going to talk about that.
Hey, watch how you talk about us, Dex.
Yeah.
May I?
Sure. Vice Chairman Orman.
Well, I would like to. I have a couple of comments that I would like to make. One, Judge Thompson,
We're only going to talk about Mr. Ford for a second so he can speak.
No, I'm going to segue. I'm segueing. But I'm going to remind Judge Thompson that people...
Vice Chair, I don't want to debate his points.
I'm not debating him. I'm just telling him, as a county next door, we know how well off they are.
But
I would like to say that the Ford Family Foundation provided a lot of opportunities in Hood River County. And Hood River County is deeply indebted to the Ford Foundation.
Thank you, so please.
Well, thank you, Chairman Clem and other members of the committee. I appreciate your support. Certainly the foundation, we're very proud, and we're very supportive of rural Oregon. We think a lot of our roots and where we come from. My comments today, of course, I'm here to talk about the need for continued state support in biomass power generation. It's a little bit different than the foundation world. And I'm here wearing my corporate hat as president of Roseburg Forest Products, and also a member of Oregon Forestry Industry Council. For you that are not aware of Roseburg Forest Products, we employ 2,000-plus Oregonians in southwestern Oregon. We are a family-held company. We are fully integrated in the fact we start from the woods all the way to the customer. We're lumber, plywood, composite panels, engineered wood panels, the full range, and we also generate power. We've had a 35-megawatt power plant for over 40 years. And so we have a lot of experience in this area, and we also, I would say, are certainly a leader in developing the development of residual fuel resources, which is coming into this next generation of power plants, which is part of the Oregon plan. I would assume we all agree that biomass power generation is good for Oregon. I use the expression, it's a triple win. It's a good source of energy, which is firm supply, but it's also good for the environment. We have a real crisis developing in the management of forest lands, especially in eastern Oregon, and even in southwest Oregon as it relates especially to federal lands. From the standpoint of disease, from the standpoint of catastrophic fire, there's a lot of things going on in our land that needs treatment. And certainly biomass power generation is part of that process. And the other thing that's good about biomass power generation, it is in rural communities. We don't build power plants in downtown Portland. We're looking at a small, we're talking about plants from 1 megawatt up to 50. So there's a wide range, but we're located out where the communities are. We're located out where we need the jobs. The power generation business is very, very complex. There's no one model what works in eastern Oregon, what works in southwest Oregon, what works in the Willamette Valley. They are all different. But they all require a long lead time. Where wind power may be 2-3 years. We're talking in the biomass power business, probably 3 to 5 years at least. And again, of course, it's also in support of forestry. And it's another leg of the stool that we need in Oregon and the development of our second generation of timberland. So there's a lot of good things about it. Presently, unlike wind, we are really just getting started. The legislature, of course, in the last two sessions has created a body of law at the federal level. I think it was, 2007 or what? There was a Federal Energy Act. So a lot of things are really just getting started in the biomass business. It's a three-stage process, and when we look at a power facility, we're looking for an investment of at least 20 years. So we have to develop a long-term fuel supply. We have to negotiate a 10 to 20-year power sales agreement. We have to locate, permit, finance, train people, and build the plants and build forestry systems or independent contractors wanted to feed these plants on a continued basis. So effectively, our industry in this area is only 5 years old when we talk about this next generation. We're dealing with a whole new body of legal law, administrative systems. We use terms of RPS, REC, REC rules, and it's just a whole new language, and all of us are still trying to figure out what all this stuff means. And again, it ranges from small independent facilities to large, what I would call cogeneration plants. The problems we're dealing with today is that the recession has really affected this process. What we saw and heard back 2-3 years ago and what we are dealing with today is entirely different. First thing is the power demand in our state and in our country, of course, has dropped dramatically because of the slowdown in industry and, frankly, the impact of some wonderful things happening in the conservation area. So the ability to go out and get short-term contracts, I'm talking 2, 3, 4, 5 years today, is very difficult and basically today not very economical when you look at biomass. But certainly in the long term, in Oregon and looking to other parts of the nation, this power is a very economical source. So what we're dealing with here is a transition, is trying to how to get through the next 2 or 3 years and enable the people that have started committing to projects to be able to get them finished. There's been a lot of discussion, you know, the project down in Lakeview. I think there's been a new plant announcer working in Lapine. And in southwestern Oregon, we're talking basically about totally taking our plant down and rebuilding a new modern facility. It's in the neighborhood of 35 megawatts. When you talk about these plants, it's basically the cost today is about $2.5 million a megawatt when you talk about that. So in a plant like ours, we're talking $85, $90 million. And frankly, that's real money. And to put that kind of money together today when the laws and the rules are really in interpretation, they're being developed. Let's say we're in a very tender age. I think Senator Wyden yesterday used the word coming out of the crib. Well, maybe we're crawling at this stage. But what's happening is I think it's good for Oregon, but we need some protection. We need support till we can get onto our feet. I have furnished to you a list under the old FIC heading of a number of issues and questions. I'm not going to go through all those today, but I would like to highlight maybe a couple. Like everybody else, we're concerned about the loss of Betsy credits, and certainly in the biomass area, the $10 per green ton tax credit, which is due to expire. And we need 2 to 3 years to get us into, hopefully, when the economic cycle gets on a spin and we can get these plants online. A conceptual issue is recognizing the carbon neutrality of biomass. There's a lot of people that look at when you burn wood, there's smoke in the air. You know, everybody's got a fireplace can figure that out. But understanding the whole cycle with the idea we grow the trees, we capture the carbon, we burn this wood, generate power in a very controlled situation, we plant the new trees, the cycle, it goes around and around. And like wind power, we are carbon neutral. And I guess what's happening in our debate, there's some debate at the national level and our state level, is to try to retain focus on the science and on the concept we're looking to the long term. A definition of woody biomass, it's surprising, is what is woody biomass? Is it a tree? When we talk about cogeneration, is it wood comes out of a landfill? What exactly is it? And we need to, frankly, we need to get that definition worked out. And again, providing education on what we're working with the small landowner and the private forester, because it's all tied together. We're looking at fuel supply 12 months of the year. We're not looking at just in the summers. So we're looking at developing systems. We're looking at developing people, subcontractors that are sustainable through that time period. And, of course, we also would like to see something happen on our federal lands. You look at where most of our plants are sited throughout Oregon, there's a lot of federal forest. And there's a big debate as to why we would even think of the idea of pulling biomass out of the federal lands. And I think that debates, the state has a role in that. Sometimes here in Oregon we tend to say, well, we're just one of the world. You are the Saudi Arabia of the biomass world today. And these, and frankly, our state needs your leadership. With that, thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'm available.
Well, thank you, and I wanted to acknowledge Senator Edwards' role in the biomass world, who's joined us. He had a challenging but eventually successful job in dealing with this issue during the supplemental session, and it was important work to get done to help with some of those acronyms you mentioned and how this counts in those acronyms. So questions for this group in its entirety at this point? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Thompson, I'm very intrigued with the information you handed out, and I don't have the related information and wonder if you have it available. These projects were all beneficiaries of the Betsy tax credit, if I understand it correctly. Do you know how much each project benefited from that tax credit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I don't. They're not all representative of the Betsy. The Klondike 1 and Klondike 2, I believe, were not did not receive the Betsy, but the other three did. The Bigelow, the Hay Canyon, and the Klondike 3 all received Betsy.
Mr. Chair, I don't think anyone from Department of Revenue or Department of Energy is here to answer that. So you're the expert on this subject in the room. Perhaps the committee would benefit from getting that information.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, if you're looking for the amount of dollars that Betsy these projects received, they would have received the full amount of Betsy because of their size, and the Betsy would have been capped at $20 million of construction costs, although these projects are far more, and they would have received 50%. They would have received $10 million. And I would believe that these companies absorbed their own Betsy and did not look for pass-through partners. They're all Oregon-based companies that have enough tax revenue that they could absorb the Betsy themselves.
The Bigelow project is PGE. Hay Canyon and Klondike 3 are Iberdrola, located in downtown Portland.
Yeah, Representative Wainwright.
Just for clarification on that, when you say that one project received the one full amount, I had read something about one maneuver that was being used was to, it would build an array of windmills, but they would structure them legally so that they were, each one was separate, and access the Betsy on each and every one. So I just want to make sure when you answer that question, because I don't know the details of these specific projects.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, the Hay Canyon, you're talking about they were taking 100 megawatt projects and building a number of 100 megawatt projects and calling each one of them separate. The Star Point and the Hay Canyon are each 100 megawatt projects, and they did that with these two. That was Iberdrola. They took the money from Hay Canyon that they got from Betsy, and put it into Star Point, or into Star Point, which isn't even on here yet. Am I right?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, now I'm confused. Judge Thompson, and maybe we should ask the Department of Energy to do this, but what I heard you say is some of these projects might have actually been presented for purposes of Betsy as more than one project, as multiple projects, in order to get multiple credits.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I might have spoke out of turn.
Not popping your head up on this issue. Remember that. I remember. Good call.
I'm not really positive on the Hay Canyon and Star Point. Star Point shows no dollars received yet. That has not gone in. That'll go under the tax rolls in 2011-12.
Not to belabor, but
yeah,
the second line on your chart, add fee.
Additional fee.
Judge Thompson, what is that? Because a third of the number, the benefit to Sherman County, comes from the additional fee that Bigelow
contributed. Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, we call that a wind fee. It's a negotiated fee that I and two other individuals negotiated with the companies in order to get our signature on a SIP.
We're going to disengage from this conversation at this point because we've got a short timeline, and as I said, we're going to show some mercy here and not get into this. This will be an ongoing conversation all session, I guarantee it. I have two other members who are here to hear about the next topic, Senator Johnson and Representative Shoffler, who are both also big biomass people. You just missed a nice conversation, Representative. We have two more people on this topic, so I'm actually going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Van Orman so Senator Edwards and I can go do an agenda item in a meeting we have to begin in about 6 minutes, and ask our other panel, Jeff and Don, our Sherman County farmer, to please join us. And I'm going to just step outside. I apologize, but we have to get an agenda approved for a meeting that starts in a few minutes. That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Ford. Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Paul.
Mr. Chair,
are you going
for our meeting?
Yeah, actually,
continuing with Mr. Ford's metaphor, I think we should refer to the senator as Sheikh.
Oh, it's the Sheikh?
Yes, sir.
Well, if it's the Saudi Arabia, somebody's got to be the Sheikh. Yeah, let's.
I think it's Sheikh.
Do you want to come talk about that?
Sheikh.
You don't say
Sheikh. It's Sheikh. Sheikh. No, thank you.
Sheikh.
Only an actor would know this.
Sheikh.
Is there one in the room?
No, not a
okay, room. I just
only if you have Harim. Well, good afternoon. Oh, good morning. It feels like afternoon, doesn't it?
To the
so was I.
I had as much success as
you. I refer you, Madam Chair. Are you?
I think I'm referred to as Vice Chair.
Vice Chair, and members of the committee.
They don't get that.
For the record, my name is Don Coates, and I'm a wheat grower from Sherman County. I live in the Dalles, and I farm in Sherman County. I guess I'd like to just tell a little story about my experience with wind energy and my efforts to develop a smaller project. 10 years ago, a fellow showed up in Sherman County whose name was Bruce Morley, who had been involved in a wind project in Wyoming. It was called the Foot Creek Rim Project, and some people in Oregon are familiar with it because I think OWEB actually owned a piece of that project. At any rate, he came to Sherman County and had a meeting, invited a lot of landowners in the county who had what he perceived to be land that was attractive for wind development, and presented a slideshow showing this wind farm that had been built in Wyoming, and told the story of a number of landowners who had struggled financially for quite a long time with their operations, who now had turbines on their property generating electricity and receiving royalties, and their cattle operations were still intact, and it looked like maybe they were going to be able to hang on to their farms for another generation. And
It was a pretty rosy whole picture, and everybody in the room was pretty taken with the idea. And there were still a lot of questions, but in general, people were thinking, "Wow, you know, maybe Sherman County could put wind turbines in." Well, 10 years later, there are about 500 of them up. And but when I left the room, my neighbor and I both were smitten with this concept, but we also were open-minded enough to realize that there could be some drawbacks to this industry and that we ought to spend some time to study it. And we did, and we were able to go up to Umatilla County, where the State Line project had been constructed a couple years earlier, and meet with a grower there, a wheat grower who had turbines on his property, and try and get a better understanding of what the industry was all about. And this fella, an elderly guy, and he gave us a 4-hour tour probably of his farm, and he was definitely pleased with the project as a whole. But you know, when you live in a rural area like we do, if you see two guys go across your field one day, that's a big day, you know. I mean, and he had some adjusting to do to get used to the increased traffic and busyness that's associated with the construction phase of these projects. It's once they're up and running, they're pretty benign, but during the construction phase, there is a fair amount of activity and a lot more people around. And at any rate, we came home thinking that we kind of like this concept for wind. And within a year, a fellow named Brett Wilcox, who had formerly run the aluminum industry there in the Mid-Columbia area, had installed a 16-turbine wind farm, the first wind farm in Sherman County. And that's where Paul Wooden, who spoke before me, was employed. He constructed and operated that first wind farm there. And my vision was that this is pretty neat, but it'd be even neater if you could figure out a way that you could own a piece of a project rather than just leasing your property off to a large developer and only receiving the royalties that were associated with having someone else's project parked on your property. And as I spent the next 6 or 7 years studying how to do that, it's been a roller coaster ride, and it has an awful lot to do with policy. The very first issue that we ran into in the idea of a community-owned project was that the current laws in the state of Oregon in regard to small generators only provided the generator with a five-year power purchase agreement for a 1-megawatt project. And the technology we were talking about wouldn't work under those circumstances. You can't even a single turbine, which I spent a couple years trying to develop a single turbine project. It's called the China Hollow Wind Farm. And, it was a $2 million project, and you could not finance a $2 million project on a 5-year power sales agreement. So through the help of Sherman County, Paul Wooden, and others, we were able to persuade the PUC in the state of Oregon to change the rules to support this concept for a smaller scale projects that could harvest the resources that we had in our area. And there's been a lot of support in the state for this concept for smaller scale renewable projects, and there are some fundamental reasons for it. Distributed generation. I don't know how familiar you are with that concept, but it's the opposite of centralized generation, which America is probably more tuned into, where you have large generators and a massive transmission system. This is the other side of that, where you got very small generators sprinkled all over the place that are closer to their loads. And yes. And there's a distinct advantage to that. However, the disadvantage is that it's much more costly to build a small project than it is to build a large project. The economies of scale play into it heavily, especially in wind. So you need support from policy in order to make these smaller projects happen. We derived a lot of support out of the Department of Energy and the PUC. The Betsy was a key part of all this. It was considered a given for years. Everyone in the industry considered the Betsy to be a a fundamental part of the development of these smaller projects. Another big hurdle that we ran into was developing partners in the projects that could utilize the tax credits, because so much of the policy that supports these smaller projects revolves around tax credits. You have to have a partner who has a huge appetite for tax credits. And these huge wind farms have, there's, you know, a dozen players in North America, and they have their network of large corporations who utilize the tax credits, and it's much more difficult hurdle for a smaller project to develop those relationships and have, you know, come up with a partner who's willing to invest with you and utilize the tax credits. So over the course of time, we finally developed some of these partners that were interested in helping to build small-scale projects. We're still talking, you know, if you go to a 10-megawatt project, you're talking a $20-plus million project. So these are not baby businesses. They're fairly significant investments. And by the time we got the PURPA rules adjusted to accommodate a longer power purchase agreement and developed partners that would work with us, the wind industry had kind of taken off, and the availability of turbines became nearly impossible for a small project developer. You couldn't get a turbine vendor to return your phone call. They didn't want to talk to somebody who only wanted to buy five or six turbines. They wanted to sell 50 of them to a large developer. So, you know, I'm basically describing all these, this roller coaster that goes on as you try and develop a smaller project in the state. And the most recent kind of calamity has been that when the downturn of the economy in 2008, the demand for the tax credits dried up because people aren't making any money. They don't have a tax liability. They don't need the tax credits. The federal government stepped in with the Stimulus Act that provided the investment tax credit. That kind of it provided a mend for that issue temporarily. That actually expires on December 31st of this year, unless Congress does something to get it going again. So, you know, currently I can talk to a turbine vendor. There's about four of them out there that would be happy to sell me $15 million worth of turbines, but I can't count on having a tax credit. And so this uncertainty, the lack of consistent policy that can be counted on, I think Mr. Ford's comments about the lead time on these projects, If you can't count on the policy remaining the same from the time you start to the time you build, you're not ever going to start. And that's where I am right now. I'm to be honest, I'm about ready to forget it. I've spent 9 years trying to put something together and thought I was on my way several times, and it's become increasingly frustrating because currently this Betsy thing is completely, I've applied twice for the Betsy. I sent a $35,000 check in with an application a couple years, or let's see, it was last spring in March after the special session had not quite ended, and had the application sent back, told I have to reapply under the new rules, and I turned around and did that again right in the middle of harvest this summer. I got the application in just as harvest started, and I was ranked 17th out of 22 applicants, and I think they accepted the top three. And it won't work without that. And so, you know, Paul's comments about the value of those Betsys, I'm not an economist, but I can tell you that when these projects get built, they're not going to disappear. They're there for 20 years or 30, and they're going to pay property taxes, and they're going to employ people, and they're going to be something that wasn't there before. And the only true experience that I think I can point to and that really relates is the Patu wind farm, which is it's a 10-megawatt wind farm that Foreman Hildebrand constructed in Sherman County, and he's the only guy that has succeeded in our state with what this model that we've been attempting to build. And and he got the stars aligned, and he got the Betsy. He was pre-certified several years ago, and he's up and operational. And you know, I think his success will be something that we can point to and determine exactly what the benefits are to the state and the community as a result of that Betsy having been there for him. And I guess the last thing, there was a handout that had my name on it, and it was a there's a, recently the Department of Health and Human Services has been surveying people who live or may live in the proximity of wind turbines about their concerns for health risks, and the letter that is circulated here was my response to their survey. And I guess I just sum it clear up by just saying I was offended that we're spending any resources whatsoever to provide a platform for people who think there's some health risks, because there are no health risks that are associated with them. And if there's any reason that the Department of Health and Human Services be involved, it would be to educate people that there are no health risks that are associated with wind turbines. So that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for traveling so far, too. Jeff, I am going to ask you to, you can have a choice. Either literally take about 30 seconds, or we need to quickly leave this, do a open a work session, pass a motion, then we can come back for a few minutes.
I'd be fine with the second one, Mr. Chair.
Okay, great. Okay, so I'm going to close our informational here, recess our informational hearing. I'm going to open a work session. That's all I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, recognizing full well that we are not necessarily, we just need to say this,
yeah,
we are not necessarily saying that we support these bills in their final form, but that we are, as a committee, saying these should be discussed and should be committee bills for discussion in the next session. I am happy to move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills.
Okay, Representative Gilliam moves that LCs 1051, dated 10-6-10, LC 1278, dated 9-8-10, LC 1284, dated 9-24-10, LC 1770, dated 10-25-10, LC 1774, dated 10-26-10, LC 1907, dated 11-23-10, LC 2166, dated 11-18-10, LC 2517, dated 11-11-10, LC 2573, dated 11-23-10, LC 2889, dated 11-22-10, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Again,
the caveat is there's no obligation to support these bills. Some of them, I'm quite certain I won't even support in the end. But this is this process we go through to have committee bills introduced.
And it must be comforting, Mr. Chair, to know that if something happens to OB, you have another job.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Further discussion? Any objection? Not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And I close the work session and come out of recess on our other topic and give the gavel back, because Representative Gilliam and I are due with Senator Edwards in another meeting negative 10 minutes ago.
Okay.
Thanks,
Simon.
Okay. Same room.
Okay. We're ready for Jeff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board, and I will be quick. I probably couldn't have been 30 seconds quick, but I'll probably be 145 seconds quick. You've heard a lot of specifics about renewable energy investment in rural areas. I just want to sort of close and give you a policy framework quickly as you move into considering these issues in the 2011 session. As a consumer advocate, I'm primarily focused on rates and how ratepayers and the resources that serve ratepayers are priced. Renewables do have rate benefits. They have long-term price stability. We have future-proofing of rates against future carbon and other fossil fuel regulations. And as a ratepayer advocate, frankly, I don't care where those resources are built. They can be built in Idaho. They can be built in Washington. They can be built in Wyoming, as long as that power that is generated gets to our utilities grid. But as citizens and as taxpayers, we have other interests. We have interest in economic development. We have interest in building new industries. We have interest in generating tax benefits for both the state and local governments. And in order to accomplish all of that for both from both the ratepayer perspective and the taxpayer and citizen perspective. We need a balanced approach that benefits all of those perspectives. We need to build generation resources that stabilize rates, and those same resources can benefit rural areas, as we've heard. As Mr. Ford was talking, and I was glad that he got the recognition that he and his family did, is rightly so. The question is, how do rural communities, which are made up by rural families, how do they support themselves in the future? My grandfather worked for Roseburg Lumber for 30-plus years, living in Winston, working in Dillard. And the timber and lumber industry that supported my grandfather and his family is gone. And I think the question that partly drives this is, what's next for rural communities? And that kind of goes back to the balanced policy approach that I talked about before. We've had that balanced approach in incenting new forms of energy, and we need to keep that approach while still recognizing the fiscal realities that we have today. In other words, we need to operate within today's budget, but we can't forget investing in the future, and which is the future that we have as ratepayers, as taxpayers, as consumers, as business people, and as citizens. And that concludes my comments. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for serving as our chair, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, because I'm supposed to be in another meeting, of course, but Mr. Coates, I'm going to ask you a question, and before I ask it, I want you to know that I'm on your side, even though the question may not sound like that. I find it interesting that when Mr. Wooden, I think, began to speak about pouring cement, about hiring people, putting people to work, that my friend Representative Schaffler walked in the room. So I understand and I get the fact that we're creating jobs on the front end, and I support that. I also believe very deeply in what renewables can mean for rural Oregon. But my question to you is, generally speaking, would you say the energy being generated from wind farms in your area, where's that energy going and most of it being used?
Madam, I'm not good on the formality. Madam Van Ormond, Representative Gilliam. To the best of my knowledge, well, for the projects like I'm trying to develop, we have to sell to a regulated utility. So we have to sell to either PacifiCorp or PGE, or actually there's a provision where we could sell to Idaho Power if we were in there on the far eastern side of the state. The large wind projects sell to whoever offers, whoever they bid into. And some of that I know goes to California, but I really couldn't tell you how much.
Okay, just to follow up, yes. Madam Chair, and I will be brief because I know my colleagues are now fearing a hydrogen seminar. But I do, and Jeff, I hope you'll help me with this. I do want our guests here today to know a little bit about the potential that hydrogen has, new hydrogen technology has, mm-hmm. to store power such as you're talking about at center of load for use in Oregon first, for use with farms and other agriculture uses. And I just think that we need to continue to talk about, I always want to raise this flag, about how we can integrate renewables. And I'm particularly, and not very articulate, but I'm very excited about hydrogen, and I hope that you'll look into that, or that I could, if you leave me your contact information, that you understand, because I think we can even this out, and I think we can make wind power even stronger, because those turbines, as you know, don't always turn when we want them to. But we can store it, we can store it cheaply, and we can use it in Oregon first. I'm not against lighting up Disneyland with Oregon power, but only after we use it here first. So I think a Northwest preference in any policy is absolutely fundamental to what we should be doing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Nolan.
Thank you. Just quick question, Mr. Bissonnette, and I don't know that we can answer it today, but I keep hearing this project or that project wouldn't happen without the Betsy credit. How do we, from a policy point of view, on behalf of consumers, evaluate whether the general public should be investing in projects that would not, on their own fiscal characteristics, be viable.
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, I think the reason that the policy has worked up till now is that, as a policy, we've stayed out of, you know, what works, what doesn't. Yes, ma'am.
You've talked about the project working. I'm not sure we know what working means. The question I'm asking is, if there's a project for generating energy that doesn't pencil out on its own and requires a non-trivial subsidy from the general public, how do we evaluate that from a policy point of view as a sustainable way of developing energy in the future if we have to be providing subsidies in order to make those projects work?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, let me take another run at it then. I think when you just described almost the entire energy industry, I mean, you know, whether you're talking about large scale facilities that, you know, utilities build or smaller scale facilities like Mr. Coates and Mr. Wooden have described, you know, almost every energy source, renewable or non-renewable, gets some sort of subsidy. And so the policy is not, you know, which projects pencil out or which ones don't, because almost none of them do. What the question is what is the balance of resource availability, resource stability, and economic benefits to both the state and to local communities that we can afford, you know, and trying to pay for everything that we have. And, you know, will they necessarily be as rich going forward? Probably not. You know, we have some of the larger resources, the utility scale resources, that, you know, may get very little, if any, you know, benefit from the state, where they've gotten a lot in the past, but they are closer to penciling out on their own. And so we can maybe back off a little bit on that. We have some of the smaller scale that do need help. We need up-and-coming technologies like solar, some biomass, wave, that do need help in getting going if we want to put them as an active part of the portfolio. That may take 10 or 15 years, but that's you know, a short time frame that we think of in the utility world. You know, it's not unusual to think in terms of, you know, 30 to 50 years when building resources. If we want in 30 to 50 years wave energy to be somewhat of a base load, geothermal biomass to be part of the portfolio we have to invest in today, the question is how much can we invest?
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much for coming, and thanks, Don, for coming.
Yeah,
and I'll tell Dr. Toto you wore the pin.
Okay.
We're going to have a change in order in the agenda. We're going to have the report on the Task Force on Geese Control, Senate Bill 622 of 2009, and we have Senator Johnson and Representative Schaffler. Thank you. And Ron England and Kurt Melcher will also be testifying.
Are you ready, Madam Chair?
I am ready. I think we are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Schaffler. I'm state rep from House District 48, Happy Valley, out of Southeast Portland, and I was on this committee. And I shared an interest in the geese problem we have, and the good chair saw fit to appoint me to the task force. It's been quite a great experience. I've learned more about geese than I ever wanted to know. It is a huge problem. There's been some great recommendations from the task force. I'm going to let these smart people talk about that. And they've already taken some good positive action. I'm very grateful for that. To be quite frank with you, going into it, I did not see government helping us out very much, because I think this is a microcosm of the problem we have in Oregon. We've painted ourselves in a corner in so many places.
that when a problem arises, we can't do anything about it. I mean, there are so many restrictions on dealing with these animals. It's unbelievable. But we are going forward, and I'll leave it at that. But I appreciate you taking the time. I know you've got a lot going on today, and we're already running late. I'm just going to end with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. My district is Senate District 16, and I was the sponsor of Senate Bill 622 at the request of a number of agricultural interests in my district. The goose problem is a problem in a number of arenas. This task force was motivated principally by depredation to agricultural property, but this is also a public health issue. It is an aviation safety issue, as all you have to do is look at those pictures of the airport plane landing in the Hudson River to know what a problem it is there. And as Representative Schaffler, who co-chaired the task force, pointed out, this is much more complicated than I had anticipated coming in. The practical problem on the ground, though, is for some of my farmers on Savis Island, I have actually been in their fields when flocks of upwards of 2,500 birds descend on high-value croplands. They are described by my constituents as rats with wings. They hit the ground, and they can eat a high-value crop right down to the dirt in a matter of hours. They are becoming so habituated that they're now feeding in the dark. It used to be that the farmers had a fighting chance to keep them out of the fields, but they're so habituated now they're feeding in the dark. I think we're going to hear very distressing news that the numbers that we thought were the population counts going into the task force are now vastly higher. And this is costing agriculture literally millions of dollars a year. Not to mention the aviation and public health problems. They're in golf courses. They're in parks. This is a very serious problem. Mr. Melcher will describe to you one of the complexities is that Oregon participates in a multi-jurisdictional flyway task force that causes there to have to be consensus among a number of people with varied political and geographic interests. And I think the principal accomplishment coming out of the task force was a recommendation that we took to the ODF&W Commission, asking that the Commission direct their negotiators, in this case Mr. Englund, who sits on the Pacific Flyway negotiating team, to negotiate hard on behalf of Oregon, on behalf of Oregon agriculture, to understand what a problem this is. And I believe that he will make a report along with Mr. Melcher indicating what has transpired in the treaty negotiations that occurred since the task force completed their work. I'd like to go on record as thanking the department for being as hospitable as they were to the committee. They staffed the committee and in addition gave us one final meeting to finish our work. I think you'll notice from the handout that the composition of the task force was balanced. It had a number of different interests at the table, not all of which were of like mind, but I believe, as Representative Schaffler says, that we have delivered some strong recommendations. There may be a bill in this session. I understand that there may be a bill being drafted to help refund wildlife services in the state that helps manage these populations. Given our fiscal constraints, I'm enough of a realist to know that that could have significant trouble making it through the session. But I think as long as it keeps the issue alive and hearings like this keep the issue alive, that the Oregon legislature needs to be aware of the fact that this is a definite problem for Oregon agriculture and that we eventually need to do something to act on managing these burgeoning populations. So thank you very much, and I would take any questions if there are any. Failing that, turn it over to Mr. Englund.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Englund, I guess, or Mr. Melcher, whoever.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Van Orman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I know we are up against the clock here, so I will quickly just hand this microphone off to Mr. Ron Englund, our Wildlife Division Administrator. He did actually, and his staff, led the efforts with the task force, and as the good senator pointed out, Ron is our state's representative on the Pacific Flyway Council in the federal process that regulates these populations. So with that, thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Van Orman, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Englund, Wildlife Division Administrator for ODFW. Skipping to page 2, it gets into the 14 specific recommendations that were made by the task force to our commission. And you'll note that as you go through those, we have taken action, not necessarily completed, but we have taken action on most of those recommendations up to this point in time. As people found out going into this, it is a very complex problem. We're working with international treaties. We're working with Fish and Wildlife Council, or the Pacific Flyway Council and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that has final say on what can be done with population numbers and seasons. But we are negotiating hard on increasing bag limits where we can within the adopted frameworks within the service. We've addressed goose problems in Malheur County, Klamath County, and over on the coast, both the south coast and the north coast. We are working hard to address the problems here in the Willamette Valley with an increase in numbers and cacklers. As Senator Johnson mentioned, one of the recommendations out of this task force was to renegotiate population objectives on cacklers, and we have started that process. We, along with the Oregon Farm Bureau, have met with Native Alaskans who have a subsistence say in what the population objectives would be, and they're very interested in meeting with Oregonians and helping to negotiate that. We've initiated discussions on the overall population itself, and as the Senator alluded to, some of our initial looks into the formulas that are being used show some inconsistencies in how that's been calculated, and that there probably are a lot more cacklers actually using the Willamette Valley today than what were originally estimated by the service. So we're working through that. Our technical committees are down in Arizona this week for the Flyway Council, and they're working on those population objectives. We have initiated specific things, like I said, for changing season frameworks and bag limits. Recommendation 5 on page 3, one of the things that was very important to landowners is they have the ability outside of seasons to be able to take geese that are causing damage, and we are working directly with the service and we'll be pulling landowners into the conversation on that kill permit process. It was complicated very much by Native Alaskans who don't want to see any animals wasted. They depend on these birds as their first source of fresh protein in the spring when the birds show back up. So it's a very sensitive and delicate issue that we're having to work through. It's not just a matter of going out and taking some birds that are causing damage. It's also working with the Alaskans to make sure that we don't end up with the process blown up on us. I guess the other thing I'd like to touch on is that we have, like I said, met with Native Alaskans and with the Fish and Wildlife Service. We're trying to facilitate some meetings here in Oregon and in Alaska with them and with farmers, and the Farm Bureau in particular is a representation for the farmers. We think that we'll be able to have a meeting here in Portland in mid-January when we have another goose meeting that's occurring, a national goose meeting, and a lot of the Alaskans will be down here anyway. So we'll be reporting back to this committee, I'm sure, during the session, and we'll be able to provide you more progress at that point in time. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Next, we will have the report on the Oregon Coast Fish Hatchery Reforms, House Bill 3489 of 2009, and we will have Kurt Melcher from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and Bruce McIntosh from Inland Fisheries, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Vice Chair Van Orman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, and again, I understand and that we have a very short time limit here, so we had come prepared with the PowerPoint. We will not deliver that, although you will have the written printed copies of that PowerPoint for any future reference. I do have with me Mr. Bruce McIntosh, who was one of the agency leads in preparing this report that was requested under House Bill 3489 in the 2009 session. We've worked diligently on that report over the last year and a half. We met yesterday with Representative Krieger to discuss our draft report, and he does, in fact, have a copy of the full report in his possession. It's about 200 pages long, so we spared you all that. And if someone would like a copy, we would certainly be able to provide that. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Bruce for a very quick high-level overview of the report and some of our findings, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good morning, Vice Chair Van Orman, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce McIntosh, Deputy Fish Division Administrator with ODFW. As Deputy Director Melcher said, we've delivered an executive summary of the report and then the PowerPoint, which kind of hits the high points on it. I'll try to condense those even more. As Kurt noted, House Bill 3489 called for a comprehensive review of Oregon's coastal hatchery programs. We operate 9 hatcheries on the coast. They produce 5 million salmon, steelhead, and trout annually. And our analysis shows that they do provide a net economic benefit to the communities of the coast and the citizens of Oregon. In terms of key findings from the report, based on the current management objectives for the programs, we're doing a good job of meeting those. We're meeting our production goals, we're providing a diverse set of fisheries, and are pleased with how that's going. In addition, the bill asks us to look at how we manage fish health and our effluent from these hatcheries, and we can report that we're doing a great job on that front. We're meeting our fish health objectives. We have among the strongest policies on the West Coast for that, and in terms of effluent management, we operate under permits from the Department of Environmental Quality, and we meet all the program guides under that. In addition, we have made significant progress in reducing a backlog of deferred maintenance associated with these hatcheries. In 2005, that backlog stood at about $2 million. Now it's about $1 million. We have revisited that and have a priority list on how to move forward, and we'll continue to do that through a variety of sources available to us. Based on our analysis of the program, we have concluded that the current program really needs few changes to continue to meet its objectives, although we have outlined some additional areas of investment. Keeping with the spirit of kind of a comprehensive look at these programs, their history is that they really have operated for local needs and really hatchery-specific objectives. We never have really operated them as a comprehensive system across the coast. So in keeping with the nature of the bill, we have concluded that we need to produce a comprehensive species management and utilization plan for the coast, which we began this fall and look to finish in the next 2 years. And that's really the vehicle through our policies and statutes that allow us to really realize the full benefits of the types of reforms we've talked about in the bill. In terms of key recommendations out of the report, it's to continue funding the existing program. We've been challenged over time with that program because it's 50% licensed funds, 50% general funds, and you all know better than I the challenges of meeting general fund demands. But we did a good job this biennium with our fee increase of really kind of bolstering those programs, but it will require diligence just to meet the needs of the current program. In addition, our recommendation includes what I talked about, implementing that conservation plan and getting that developed and working through things from there. A key component of that is our Hatchery Research Center, which many of you have heard about, which continues to provide cutting-edge research on the interactions between hatchery wild fish and help sort of blaze the trail for the future. So that's a quick overview of a large report. So I'll leave it at that, and if you have any questions, we'd be glad to answer those.
Well, I apologize for the brevity that we have forced you into. Are there any questions? Well, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for the work that you do in ODFW, and it's been a very great pleasure of mine to have worked with you for these past 2 years. And I do have one question, Mr. Melcher. How are the fish doing in Cascade Locks?
Thank you, Vice Chair Van Orman, and likewise, it's been a pleasure working with you over the last couple of years. The fish that you're referring to are the fish at Oxbow Hatchery that we're holding using well water from the city of Cascade Locks. Those fish are doing fine. We've seen no no ill effects or problems with that rearing. So the test continues, but things are looking very good.
And they're growing normally.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so very much. If there's no further business, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Meeting's adjourned.